Rendez-vous de la Francophonie is an annual celebration that promotes the French language, heritage, and its numerous cultural expressions. It runs March 2nd to 22nd, 2017 in communities across Canada. The RVF series, which showcases the diversity, duality, and dynamism of Canada's Francophone communities, is brought to you by La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, the National Campus and Community Radio Association, Canadian Heritage, and this station. Please stay tuned for the next half hour for this week's edition of Rendez-vous de la Francophonie. Visit ncra.ca/RVF for more information on the series.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, a radio documentary celebrating the French language leading up to the annual Francophonie Day on March 20th. My name is Cody Gardner, and I'm coming to you today from Bay of Islands Radio in Cornerbrook, a small city located on the island of Newfoundland. I would like to welcome you here today as we take a look at the rich French culture of Western Newfoundland, which is home to the only bilingual region of the province of Newfoundland and Labrador, the Port-au-Port Peninsula. The Port-au-Port Peninsula has approximately 4,500 inhabitants, which accounts for less than 1% of the province's population. There are approximately 700 French speakers in the region, 400 of whom speak French as their first language. And now to start the program, we have an interview with Dr. Rainer Baer, who is an associate professor of historical studies at Memorial University's Grenfell campus in Cornerbrook. Ivan Emke had a chance to speak with him.
Dr. Rainer Baer is a professor of historical studies and social and cultural studies at Memorial University of Newfoundland's campus, Grenfell campus, which is on the west coast of the island of Newfoundland. He's researched and written extensively about the history of various groups within Newfoundland and Labrador, and continues to do so. He joined us in our kitchen, and he came from East Curling, which is in the Bay of Islands of Newfoundland. You can hear us slurping tea and clanking cups in the background. And I asked him about the French presence in Newfoundland. Well, to start off, many people who are listening to this are probably not aware of the length of time that the French were interacting with the British and others in Newfoundland post-European developments. So that often comes under the term the French Shore. So how long were the French here during that time?
Well, the French were here before the French Shore.
Oh, okay.
So they go back to the early 16th century, so the early 1500s. And Jacques Cartier, who we identify as a French explorer who discovered St. Lawrence in Canada and so on. When he went down the west coast of Newfoundland, he discovered that there were people here who were Spanish Basques, who were from Normandy, who were Bretons, from Brittany and so on. So there were French fishers here from probably the 1520s onwards. And they were fishing both along the bank, so the south coast of Newfoundland, but also from the Straits of Belle Isle through the Gulf of St. Lawrence, along the west coast here.
And it was the fishery that brought them here, that was the attraction.
The fishery was enormously important. So long before there were many inhabitants on the mainland of Canada, there was a migratory fishery. The French migratory fishery was the largest, and the estimates are that, say, in the late 17th century, there were probably 12,000 people coming back and forth every fishing season, so between May and September. And there were an estimated 300 vessels, and these are large vessels, so they carried cannon, for example, to protect themselves. They had shallops and smaller dories, dory-type vessels, and then the fishers who were on board would go into the inshore, bring back the fish. And
that was a seasonal activity.
It was a seasonal activity. The marine resources here were enormous, and people like Jean-François Briere, who studied the Gulf of St. Lawrence, estimates that it was probably one of the most important contributions to the French economy, certainly along the French coast for several centuries.
So given the value of the fishery, I would assume that England took notice of this as well.
Absolutely. Right. John Cabot already in 1497 recognized that there were important cod stocks here. But he was met very quickly by other fishers, especially Basque fishers along the French, Spanish coastline in the Bay of Biscay. It's argued that in fact the Basque fishery had discovered North America before Columbus, and in fact Basque mariners were the ones who informed Columbus that there was a land over here. Except he went south.
Right. But we won't tell the Icelanders about that because they go back to...
That's right. Yeah.
The tourists who go up and down the coast, the northern peninsula and so on, hear about the French shore, and that's been discussed since, I guess there was a big 400-year anniversary in 2004 or something. But what was the French shore?
There are actually two French shores. So at the end of these wars between Britain and France, Britain finally gained Acadia, so mainland Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, by 1713, and it's at that point that the French headquarters in Plaisance or Placentia was moved by France to Cape Breton, to Louisbourg. And the French government, it's under Louis XIV, was insistent that they retain fishing access around Newfoundland. So the first French shore went along the north coast of Newfoundland, including the northern peninsula. And then there were more wars in the 18th century between France and Britain. And France also supported the Americans in the American Revolution. And after the American Revolution, the treaty that gave the United States independence also had a supplemental treaty that established a new French shore, which was then the northern peninsula on the west coast of Newfoundland.
And that was operational then until...
That was operational until 1904.
Until 1904.
Yeah.
So those several hundred years of interaction and the French presence here, has that had some lasting effect on Newfoundland, the territory?
It did in a number of ways. First of all, under those treaties, the French were not allowed to settle here. So they... initially, the argument was that... British subjects and the French would fish concurrently. France insisted that their rights to the shore was exclusive. So the British government essentially acceded to that, though not formally. The British insisted, however, if the French were going to take this French shore, that they would not overwinter. They used to have to leave their stages and flakes and salt supplies and boats here over winter. They were often raided by indigenous peoples from the northern peninsula to the southwest coast. Essentially, some residents then were allowed to overwinter to look after the French infrastructure. It essentially meant that Newfoundlanders could not settle here. And it wasn't until the 19th century that there was pressure by the Newfoundland colonial government to change the terms of the treaty.
So while this was happening on the West Coast, on the East Coast, were people settling?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the, cultural legacies of the French shore was that Newfoundland's identified with the Avalon and St. John's and the British migratory fishery, right? Yet there's a whole history of other peoples living in other parts of Newfoundland, fishing there, coming there seasonally, and then eventually settling, even though their numbers were pretty small.
So that kind of... division is a strong word, I suppose, but a difference between the East Coast and the West Coast.
I think it's a very obvious distinction. Certainly, until the middle of the 19th century and even later, one way of thinking about that is to look in the phone book and to look at some of the family names here. And names like Young and Bennett and White were essentially Anglicized names, colonized names of people who were whose surnames were Lejeune, Benoit, and Leblanc, right? And there were also Acadians who settled from Cape Breton, settled in the Caudro Valley and around Stephenville in the 19th century. You know, whose French roots are different, but overlap, right? So there are a lot of people, especially in this particular region of the Bay of Islands, who have, if you like, French ancestry.
So it wouldn't be fair to talk about the French and the West Coast without also talking about their relationship with the Mi'kmaq, with the indigenous people who were here, which is another difference between what happened probably on the East Coast. What was that? How was that relationship characterized?
Those people of French background who came through, and it's a very individualistic type of history. It's people who escaped from the French Navy. It's people who were Acadians who came here to fish. It's those who were guardians and decided to stay. You know, one of the these crews were exclusively male, and so those who stayed often married into the Aboriginal population, the Mi'kmaq population. What happens, though, is that they become a visible minority. Many of them live around Bay St. George, Port-au-Prince, and some of them move over into the Bay of Islands. And they, those who are French and Mi'kmaq, become the Jacatar. You know, it's a derogatory term. It's like the N-word. And people who were Jacatar hid their identity. And in fact, you know, I've heard of instances where there were potions created to make your skin whiter. So that you wouldn't stand out. Right, and they were discriminated against and belittled. I mean, even into the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And there was a community here that was very similar to Africville in Halifax called Crow Gulch, which was predominantly a Jacatar community that was relocated in the 1960s because they were considered a problematic community and a slum. Slum area.
And that was here in Corner Brook.
That was here, in Corner Brook.
So part of what's happening now among the Mi'kmaq and the sort of resurfacing of their own culture was impacted by the relationship with the French and that close connection.
So students, for example, that I've had were told not to admit not only that they were Mi'kmaq, but that they came from a French background. You know, I was went along with the anglicization of their surnames. So, for instance, when one of the major changes to this area was the construction of the American Air Force Base in Stephenville, the Ernest Harmon Air Force Base, and the Americans refused to hire anybody of Aboriginal descent.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the Halapu First Nations Band now, a number of years ago, in one of their newsletters, had an article entitled "Jacatar No More." Right. You know, it's now a symbol of the past and a term that was associated with shame, humiliation, destitution, and being a visible minority, and now that's rejected as an abject term.
It's interesting because in the Port-au-Prince Peninsula there has been slowly a sort of a rebirth of the French aspect. I mean, there's a couple of French, there's a French school, and they've tried to teach their, they've sort of lost a generation of French speakers, but now laid on top of that is the whole re-understanding of their indigenous roots as well.
Right.
Which is an interesting project.
And there's still, not only in the Bay St. George area, but in the Northern Peninsula, along the, the coast of White Bay, there are all of these small communities, many of them abandoned or resettled, that were essentially tied to the French migratory fishery.
One last flippant question, I suppose. History, it goes back and forth. You know, if we could have been, what if France had taken over the province? Would we not just have better cheese and wine. But, you know, how could things have been different? Do you ever, as a historian, do you ever sort of think about, well, what if the French had prevailed?
Well, I think it would have been a very different continent if Wolfe hadn't defeated Montcalm at the Plains of Abraham. Right. So Newfoundland, if that hadn't happened, Newfoundland would still be in a part of France.
Really? Yeah. I never thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Okay.
And once again, thank you to Dr. Baer for sharing some of his knowledge on the French history of the area. Well, up next, we're going to be heading to Nettie's Harbor, Newfoundland, and talking to Anita Best. She's going to be telling us a bit about the French influence on music in Newfoundland and Labrador.
Anita Best is a singer, a musician, a folklorist, a tradition bearer for Newfoundland and Labrador music, and she's the recipient of many other honors which she refuses to allow me to say on the radio. I met up with her in her home on a snowy afternoon in Nettie's Harbor, Newfoundland. So could you tell me a bit about, from your perspective anyways, the influence that the French, who were here for many, many hundreds of years, might have had on the music of Newfoundland and Labrador?
The music. Well, I think that there probably wasn't much influence, before, so-called modern times, before the 1960s, because the French were over on the West Coast, and the music-playing people, for the most part, were over on the East Coast. I mean, the Irish were over on the East Coast, the Irish descendants, and they seemed to be very interested in that kind of music. The singing traditions, I don't know whether they ever shared much, you know, from the point of view of the lyrical, the songs of French Newfoundlanders never took hold, except in modern time, you know, with the revival that happened in the 70s, you know, in the late 60s, 70s. But I think once Emile Benoit was brought to people's attention by Gerald Thomas, who was a Welshman who taught at the university, he was the head of the folklore department for a while, and Rufus Skinchard. And you have to, like, Rufus was very aware of his own French heritage, even though it wasn't as recent as Emile's, you know, but Rufus knew that he was of French origin. I think those two, he was brought to the attention of the wider Newfoundlanders by Wilf Wareham, who was a folklorist at Memorial University as well. And once that happened, the younger generation of of Newfoundlanders, like myself at that time, like we were in our 20s at that time, and Figgy Duff was just formed, and you know, Red Island was another band that was formed, and the Wonderful Grand Band, all of those were happening in the 1970s. And then, like, Newfoundland music became something to be really proud of, you know. I'm sure you've heard Andy Jones talking about how, you know, they, once they found out that the bay existed, you know, in St. John's. But anyway, everybody wanted to hear their own music and that, and there were two living, you know, embodiments of that music. And, of course, Minnie White, from also from the West Coast. And and then people began to realize, oh, well, there are fiddlers and accordion players everywhere, you know. So but the French, the two French ones were the ones that, that started it all. And I'd say now that with Christina Smith, and especially the violin traditions, right, the fiddle traditions, with Christina Smith and Kelly Russell, and they, you know, they collected the tunes from Emile and Rufus, and they published them, and music teachers use them now, so that they have a big influence. Their tunes have a big, big influence on on fiddle music in Newfoundland, for sure.
And Emile and Rufus were both fiddlers.
Yeah.
Which they grew up and they played for dances and so on the West Coast.
That was, well, Emile played every chance he got, and he was with a band, you know, and had various people that were playing with him. Emile was sort of like the Chuck Berry of Newfoundland folk music, really, because he played to his audience.
He
always played to the audience, and if you were on stage trying to play with Emile, you just had to follow Emile, because he might play something in A on Thursday, and it might be B flat on Friday, you know what I mean? It was, he wasn't consistent. It was just like he did what he felt, and he was totally responsive to the audience, whereas Rufus was the opposite. He always played the tune exactly the same way all the time.
Right. He was more reserved. I remember seeing him in Ottawa with Kelly Russell, Jim Payne.
Yeah.
And Kelly would want to play a tune with a slightly different version.
Yeah.
Or play it slow instead of fast. And Rufus hardly could tolerate that.
He was a real traditional player.
Yeah.
But whereas Emile was a composer as well as a traditional tune. You know, he was a tradition bearer, but he was also a creative individual and a very creative individual, actually. He was a storyteller as well. What an amazing storyteller he was.
So could people look at Emile's tunes and his stories and see some kind of French influence on that? Did he bear some of that? I mean, he was in the Port Peninsula, very French area.
Yeah, I think that it had a great deal of influence on the fiddle players and, you know, and people who played that kind of music. Mm-hmm. You know, they picked up those tunes, which they never probably would have if they hadn't heard Emile. Mm-hmm, play them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I guess there was another possibility where they might have mixed, and that would have been in the lumber camps. You know, John Ashton did a great study on the lumber camp traditions, and he discovered that there was an awful lot of passing along of songs in that tradition, because I don't think it was a very, very strong instrumental music tradition in the lumber camps, except mouth organs and things like that. But I think it was a huge, really strong song tradition. So songs from, you know, one bay in Newfoundland got transmitted via these lumber camp sessions to fellas from other bays, and then they brought them back home. So that's how those the songs, you know, ended up going all over the place.
Right, right. Yeah. And then there's the famous song that was written the guy who was trying to get his job back.
Yes, one of the divines.
Yes.
Wrote a song, The Badger Drive.
The Badger Drive. And he got his job back.
He got his job back, right. I understand. Yeah. That's the story, anyway. Yeah.
So, was there a time when people didn't really necessarily know about Rufus or Emile? They sort of went into a period of decline, or traditional music in Newfoundland when the jukeboxes came out and so on and so forth.
It was like everything. Yeah. It's like people had mahogany tables, which they tossed out, and they got in chrome sets, right? So it was really, it was to throw out the old, bring in the new.
Yeah.
And Newfoundlanders have always been interested in being in the forefront of trends. I mean, they've always been that, and they were always very international. So, you know, it wasn't sort of a backwoods type of place. So you had to be, you know, modern. And I think... Yeah, that was Rufus told that story, how he used to play often for dances and so on. And when the jukeboxes came out, there was no call for his kind of playing anymore.
So it must have been interesting for somebody like Emile, who you say was a natural performer, bearer of the French tradition, but also writer of his own songs, to all of a sudden have this great, I don't know, credibility, fame, notoriety.
Well, Emile, I don't think he was ever any happier than when he went to Louisiana. He went down to New Orleans with Figgy Duff. He was in his total element down there. He's a real Cajun, right? But the people, I don't know if you've noticed this going around Newfoundland, but like, no matter what, the people in Stephenville are going to have dances and music.
I mean,
there's a huge entertainment tradition out there where they have they never stop doing the dancing and music. And even when, you know, electric bands were on the go, there was a band every night and everybody was always out. And some of the old music was mixed in with new music and rock and roll and stuff like that. And that always happened in the Port, I think.
I think people often remark how Stephenville has still a number of nightclubs and so on that have live music, whereas Cornerbrook, larger and so on, doesn't.
No. Cornerbrook was never much of a place for music anyway, either.
Okay.
It really never was.
So why am I living there?
I don't know.
How did I end up?
Why don't you go to Stephenville? A lot more music down there. No, but I was living there in the 70s, and there was really... Tommy Macon was out there for a week, and like five people would attend, you know.
Did Emile ever play in France, too? Did he get to tour France?
I don't know, but it's possible that he did go to France with Christina or Christina Smith and Pamela Morgan, you know, took him, he went traveled a lot with those people.
Was in Labrador, there was some, was there a connection between Quebec and Labrador at any time, Labrador City and so on? I don't know.
There were French-speaking people who worked in Labrador who, yeah, probably started out life in Quebec.
Yeah.
And that, but I don't know whether there was any transfer of the music at all. Music, I don't know anything about that there.
Or even Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, which is
I know
just
there
off.
Was down on there the Muir Peninsula. Okay. There was a there was a bit of a, because that's where I'm from, down on that way. And there was a bit of the certainly the dance traditions and the music that went with dancing. There were a lot of Newfoundlanders that went to Saint-Pierre and married over there, with Newfoundland women, married in Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, and then vice versa, they would come back and see their relatives, and there would be an intermixing of the dance music, I think. I never heard English-speaking people singing French songs much, unless they were like me, French teachers, and they were interested in that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
That's what started me off in, you know, I developed an interest in the French songs of Newfoundland because I was a French teacher.
Okay. And you'd use that as part of your classes?
Yeah, and I just use that as a way of pulling. It's easier to learn a language through music than it is like straight prose, you know? So if you can hum a little tune, you get people interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah. Were there ever, or are there now, I don't know, young bands in wherever, St. John's or whatever, that are adding in French songs?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Great Big Sea has a couple of French songs on some of their things. Figgy Duff always had French songs on theirs. And Christina Smith and Gene Hewson, you know. Oh, yeah, they will add them in. Mm-hmm. And especially, there's a young fiddler now that grew up in St. John's. I think she might be anywhere, Toronto or Israel. Charlotte Ann Malashevsky, she's a fiddle player.
Okay.
And she's very interested in, you know, the French music of Newfoundland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anita, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
And thank you once again to our guest, Anita Best. Also, thank you to Ivan Emke for stopping by and chatting with her. And to close out the show today, we're going to hear a track from one of Newfoundland's cultural icons, Emile Benoit. This is a track from his 1992 album Vive la Rose, which was released just before his passing on September 3rd, 1992. He was 79 years old. The song is called Jerry's Red Mountain Jake.
Thanks for joining us for this week's edition of Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, presented by La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures, the National Campus and Community Radio Association, Canadian Heritage, and this station. To learn more about the RVF series and the National RVF Celebration, and to send us your comments, visit ncra.ca/RVF.